Well, we have the joy of opening up the Word of God tonight, and I invite you to turn to Matthew chapter 5, back to Matthew chapter 5, and I want us to go right back and pick up where we left off from last Sunday night. If you were here, we had a discussion, or really began a discussion, on verse 13, and that was, what does it mean to be the salt of the earth? I mentioned that I wanted to address this. It'll take a few weeks to get through it, and we might even continue into discussing the light of the world, even though you get one, you get the other. But the reason why I wanted to address this is because I think the church today is in a real identity crisis, and I know you think that as well. I heard some amens and some nods and some conversations afterwards. Perhaps you've been in churches where you basically just go to church, you sing the three hymns, have a sermonette for the Christianette, take up the offering and go home. And that's about the existence of your church life. Is this all we do? Is church, the Christian life rather, all about just going to church? I've mixed and mingled over the years with folks who, for lack of a better term, we'll call them traditionalists, even though probably the real name is legalists, but we'll be nice and call them traditionalists. For them, it is all about church. It is all about ticking a box. And if you mess up the tradition, they don't know what to do. What I've learned in that is that some people, and I'm not saying they're not Christians, but some people actually come to a commitment to the church before they ever come to a commitment to Christ. And Christianity is all about their commitment to Christ, their loyalty to Christ. They're saved by Christ, not saved by the church, even though being a Christian is going to church, but they seem to get it wrong. And that is partly because they don't really understand what a Christian is, and alongside of that, they don't understand what a church is. And so this is why I want to come to this text, because here Jesus helps us in our understanding of that. Specifically, what we're addressing is what the church is. What a Christian is in verses 1 to 12, which then feeds into verse 13, 14, 15, and 16. Let me just begin by reading it for us. Matthew chapter 5, verse 13. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? If it is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Now, as I said last week, what we just began addressing is what Jesus is describing here as the function of the church, the job description of the church. And in really two metaphors, he says, we are the salt. And if we are the salt, we better get that right. And then he says, we are the light. And if we are the light, then we better get that right as well. Again, just to make sure we're all on the same page as we move forward tonight. That's our purpose. We haven't defined it yet. We will define it tonight. But what he's saying is this is our function. This is our purpose in the world. As I mentioned, in verses 3 through 12, as Matthew read it in those Beatitudes, that's who we are in and of ourselves. That's us individually. When we come to the idea of light and salt, that's us corporately. In verses 13 to 16, you could even put it this way. If verses 3 through 12 is who we are, then verses 13 to 16 is what we do. Maybe that's a better way of putting it. Let me say that again. If verses 3 through 12, the Beatitudes, is describing who we are, then verses 13 to 16, you are the salt, you are the light, that is what we do. Obviously, you can hear the difference there. Notice he begins with both phrases, you are. And that's in the plural, as I said last week. That's you all. And so, when he says you all, who is he talking to? Well, we go back up to chapter 5, verse 1, and we see that he's sitting, seeing the multitudes. He went up on a mountain, and when he's seated with his disciples, they came to him, he opened his mouth and taught them. So when he says you all, y'all are the salt, y'all are the light, that he's talking to the disciples, which means he's speaking to us, which again means that this is our function, this is our duty, this is our job description in the world. I need to add that. This is our job description, job function in the world. And he says, we are the salt of the world and we are the light of the world. In other words, and this is very important, God hasn't saved us and transformed us so that we live these Beatitudes in isolation. We love the Beatitudes, we recite the Beatitudes, we want to live like the Beatitudes, but it doesn't mean we go up on a mountain into some monastic house, monastery, so to speak, and we just exercise them there. That's not what he expects. In fact, what he expects is contact and confrontation in the world. He expects us, that is Jesus, expects us to live in the world amongst unbelievers with these Beatitude attitudes. Otherwise, verses 10 to 12 doesn't make any sense. I mean, you look at verses 10 to 12, or rather, verses 10 to 12, what does he say? Blessed are you who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward that is in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. So you've got these verses that talk about how you are to rejoice in your persecution that are sandwiched between the Beatitudes and our job description. And so the logic goes, if you're living a Beatitude attitude life, or the blessed attitudes, as someone said, you're doing it out in the world. And if you're doing it out in the world, there's going to be a reaction from the world. Right? I mean, if you live like a true Christian, exemplifying Christ and manifesting the fruit of the Spirit in all that you say, in all that you do, you're going to get a reaction. The world is going to react, right? They're going to harass you. They're going to revile you. They're going to persecute you verbally, if not physically. And Jesus says, expect it. But then the question comes, well, what should our reaction be? If that's the world's reaction, what should our reaction be? I mean, what do we do in response to a hostile world? You see, this is more than just a question of identity crisis. This is very relevant in our time. Because we're starting to feel the heat, aren't we? So what is our response to the living in a hostile world? You could pack up the bags and move to Iceland, I guess, or Greenland or Antarctica. You could go withdraw somewhere in a monastery or stay put and not say anything. You could be silent. You could be secluded. You could be evasive. That's not what Jesus says here, though. No. What's our reaction to all the hostility in the world? What's Jesus say? Rejoice. That's what he says. Rejoice, verse 12, and be exceedingly glad. Why? Why? Why should we be rejoicing and being exceedingly glad? Why? Because for great is your reward in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. In other words, he's saying, guess what? When you get persecuted, you rejoice and be exceedingly glad because that puts you in a very good company. The world hates me, Jesus says, and it hates my prophets. The world persecuted me, and it persecuted my prophets. So, if persecution comes to you, notice, for righteousness' sake, and that needs to be underlined, not because you're obnoxious and rude. For righteousness' sake, Jesus says, you're identified with me. In the sense, that's your badge. Isn't that good? It means that you're wearing the right uniform. This is your badge that you belong to me. And if you know that, you know that you are Christ and heading for heaven, that should be cause for what? Rejoicing and being exceedingly glad. But, here's a second thought. Your reaction to a hostile world is not just rejoicing and being exceedingly glad. The other reaction to the world, and this comes in verses 13 and 14, is that you are salt and light to them. You see the flow of thought here. It's not silence, but proclamation to them. It's not withdrawal, but manifestation to them. It's the proclamation and the manifestation of Jesus Christ to the world that must be our reaction. Nothing less. Let me say that again, just to make sure we're all together here. It's the proclamation and the manifestation of Jesus Christ to the world that must be our reaction. And so Jesus says, this is our duty. This is our function in the world. How did Paul put it? We preach Christ to every man, warning every man, teaching every man in all wisdom, right? Remember he said that in Colossians 1? Or as he puts it here, we're shining our lives in such a way that they may see our good works and glorify God in heaven. Again, in simple terms, this is what it means to be salt and light in the world. We're preaching, we're teaching the gospel of Jesus Christ, and we're living a holy and pure life that reflects that gospel. Both word and deed. Otherwise, they can't see your good works, can they? They may hear about the gospel, but they need to also see your good works. So this is what we do. This is what we do as a church. This is our function. This is our relationship in the world. We're salt and light. Can you imagine if every church on every street corner understood that? Wouldn't that be amazing? I mean, here we are, it's literally St. John's Park Baptist Church on the corner of Humphreys and Adenzer, and we're this little light that's shining in the community. But can you imagine if all the churches, the church up there, the church down there, and the church over there, all the Christian churches, not pointing to the Buddhist temple, just so you know, but all the Christian churches did what Jesus asked us to do, it would be this collective light and collective salt, right? You know, Peter got in on this. He says in 1 Peter 2:5, just listen. He says, you are a holy priesthood. Remember he says that? And he's borrowing the language of Exodus 19, the same language that when God says to Moses, bring my people forward and I'll come down. I'm going to make a covenant with them. And they're going to be, the Hebrew word there is segola, which means that my cherished treasure, my precious treasure, a people unto myself. And then he says, they will be a kingdom of priests to me, a holy nation. And it's interesting, Peter combines the two, kingdom of priests, holy nation, and he says holy priesthood. I don't know if you ever understood that metaphor in the Old Testament. Because if you understand in the Old Testament, there in Exodus 19, you'll understand what Peter is saying. Let me just tell you what it means. A kingdom of priests. I think you get a holy nation. It is a nation. There's Egypt to the south and Babylon to the right and Syria up there and Lebanon up there. And they're all nations. This one's going to be a holy one, a set apart for God alone. They are his people. So we get that. What does he mean by a kingdom of priests? And mark the language. It's not a kingdom with priests. That was a given. I mean, there were Levites all throughout the kingdom, weren't they? Remember, Levites didn't have an allotted land. They were scattered all throughout. Why? The Levites were teachers, right? They were the resident teachers. They surely worked in the temple and they ministered the sacrifices and all that. But when they didn't work in the temple, when they weren't rostered in on the temple, they lived wherever they came from, and while they were living where they were, they would be the resident teachers. Great definition of a priest is in Malachi 2. Truth is on their lips. The knowledge of God is on their lips. So they are a kingdom with priests. Israel as a nation is to be a kingdom of priests. That is to say, the gospel witness and the gospel proclamation and the teachers go well beyond the Levites. It was for everybody. They as a whole were a kingdom of priests. Does that make sense? So when Peter takes that, basically he's saying that the church's function is exactly the same type of function Israel was. We are a kingdom of priests. We are the ones that communicate God's word, the gospel of Jesus Christ, to every creature. Sure, we are a holy nation in the sense that we're not a nation, but we are to be holy. And I think that's why he puts them together. Not a holy nation, but a holy priesthood. Because we're not a nation, but we're a church. And we're scattered throughout the whole world. And we're to do the exact same job description Israel was to do. And that is to be the teachers wherever we go, right? Isn't that the Great Commission? Go. As you go. It's a participle. It does have an imperative command to it. But the way you translate the Great Commission is as you go. And the assumption is you're going to go. Wherever you go. Now, it couldn't be official. We can have the official missionaries, and we could come have them up here, and we could ordain them and commission them, and we can send them to the far corners of the earth. Or, you know what? You might get a job transfer up to Brisbane, or you might get a job transfer over to wherever you get a job transfer to. And so you're going. And the point is, as you go, you proclaim and you teach. And we come back to Jesus' words here then. It's the same thing. It's a different metaphor, but it's basically the same idea here. It's the same mission. We are his witnesses. We are his ambassadors. Let me put it another way, and even a bit stronger. Jesus didn't save us to huddle us together just to have fun. I'm all for fun. I'm all for huddling. But that's not what we are about. He has saved us. He has sanctified us. He has equipped us to go into the world so that others, too, can be saved and sanctified as well. Right? I know I'm preaching to the proverbial choir here, but we need to hear this. I mean, you think about it. You're saved. You're sanctified. You are being equipped. Let me back up and say it this way. You're saved, then why are you still here? I've mentioned this before, but we'll say it again. Why are we still here when we do so many things, so many of the duties and the commands of a believer we would do so much better in heaven, right? Your worship would be better in heaven, yeah? Your love for Christ would be better in heaven. Your love for each other would be better in heaven. We would serve each other better in heaven. So why aren't we there yet? Why are we here? One word. Evangelism. You got that? Evangelism. You can't do that in heaven. Right? We're here. We evangelize. This is the function of the church. Our primary task is to go out into the world so that others too can be saved and sanctified as well. And as I said, that's all bound up here in these verses. That is what salt and light reflect. It's reflecting the evangelistic mission of Christ's disciples. But let's unfold that a bit. Let's unpack it, so to speak. So let's go back. And as we began last week, just setting up the context, setting up the foundation, and doing so by really looking at the whole verse, and all the verses really, verse by verse and word by word. But when Jesus says, you are, and by the way, remember I told you, this is in fact you and you alone. There's nobody else. You and you alone are the salt of the earth. There's nobody else. And then he says, if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. So what does that mean? And we've got the idea, but let's break it down. What is the metaphor being salt really getting at? Well, to help us work through this, last week I gave you a 4-point outline. And I want to pick up where I left off. Four great truths. We only got through the first one last week, and that was the presupposition. Let me give you, by the way, the 4 points, and then we can go back. Number one was the presupposition. Number two, the purposes. Number three, the pitfalls. And number four, the plan. That's how we're going to unravel this thought that we are the salt of the earth. The presupposition, the purposes, the pitfalls, and the plan. Last week, we only got a chance to cover the presupposition. So let me just review that real quick and then bring us up to speed where we're at. And the presupposition, if you remember, comes in the phrase of the earth. Or in light of the world, the presupposition is of the world. And remember, they're in parallel to one another. When Jesus says, you are the salt of the earth, that's exactly saying the same thing, just different words, but synonymous. That's a function of Hebrew parallelism. You are the salt of the earth equals synonymous with you are the light of the world. And the presupposition is found in the two ending words, earth and world. Earth and world are synonyms. They're referring to the same thing. So, by the way, if you hear me say you are the salt of the world, I might mess that up every once in a while. You know I mean salt of the earth. Earth and world are the same thing. But here's the presupposition. When we're talking about the earth and we're talking about the world, we're talking about the spiritual earth and the spiritual world. We are talking about the spiritual state of the people in the world. We're talking about the curse that God has placed upon the world. We're talking about the God and the rulers of the world. That's the presupposition. You got that? We're talking about a world that is dark, a world that is defiled, a world that is impure, a world that is evil, a world that is corrupt. We're talking about an unholy place. I know you know that's how the Bible describes it. The world is in the palm of the evil one, right? The world runs a course, Ephesians 2, that's run by the God of this world. Things aren't getting better, things are getting worse and worse and worse. Now, if that's the presupposition, that the earth is corrupt, remember I took you to Genesis 16, that every single thought and the intentions of the heart of man was only evil continually, right? And the flood didn't change that. That's how we are even to this day. The spiritual state of the world and the spiritual state of the earth is in a very bad shape. And if it is defiled and if it is decayed and if it is corrupt, then what the earth needs very desperately is what? Salt. It needs salt. But then comes the question, well, what does that mean? What does that mean? What does that look like? In other words, how are we to be salt of the earth? I mean, we are the salt of the earth, but what does that mean so we can rightly function as salt? Well, that takes us to our second point. The second truth, and that is the purposes. The purposes. What is the purpose or purposes of salt? Obviously, if we're going to be salt to the earth, then we better understand Jesus' intention of the metaphor. And I'll admit, this took quite a bit of work trying to pinpoint exactly why Jesus uses the picture of salt. Light did a little bit easier, granted. And obviously, back then, they would have picked up the metaphors right away and understood it. For us, it's a bit of work. What does he mean when he says, you are the salt of the earth? We get that the earth is the problem. We are the solution, and that is being salt. But what does that mean? Well, in my study, looking at dictionaries and commentaries, I collated about 11 different uses of salt in ancient times. Just again, to help us understand the metaphor. Some of them are still being used today. I thought that was quite interesting. Of those 11 that have potential of being the meaning behind Jesus' words here, I won't give you all 11. I've kind of narrowed it down. I've narrowed it down to 5 possibilities. And I just want to work through those 5 with you tonight. In fact, scanning a dozen or so commentaries, these were the 5 that were the most often cited. That's why I chose these 5. Before I give you those 5, let me say something up front, just by way of a preface. I do believe Jesus had one primary sense when he said, "You are the salt." I do believe he had one primary sense. But as you hear these 5, you'll say, "Aha, that makes sense." Until I get to the next one and you go, "Oh, wait, that one makes more sense." And then you go to the next one. "Ah, that makes sense." In many respects, they all make sense. And so there might be some overlapping secondary application, but there's only one right interpretation. And I'm going to give you my best shot at telling you which one I think is right. Okay? So what are those 5 possibilities? And I'm going to give them to you in ascending order. That is, from the least likely to the most likely. You can see, the first 4 aren't really my favorite pick until I get to number 5, which will be my favorite pick. So let's get started. This will be a fun exercise and just study hermeneutics. Number one, the idea behind being salt of the earth is that salt in ancient times was a great commodity. And that was true. Salt was a great commodity and very valuable. And so the transfer to us becomes, well, Christians are great, God's great commodity and value in the earth. That would be the translation and interpretation from that. Salt was a great commodity and very valuable, and so Christians are God's great commodity and valuable in the earth. As I said, we're going from least likely to most likely. Some, however, really argue for that. Some hold to this. The point behind this is salt was a very important commodity in ancient times. Roman soldiers were paid with salt. In fact, our word salary comes from the word salt. You probably heard the phrase, "He's not worth his salt," right? It goes back to ancient times when they were paid with salt. I mean, if he's not worth it, you don't pay him. He's not worth his salt. Don't pay him. So with that in mind, some think that when Jesus is saying, "You are the salt of the earth," he is saying this: you are the most valuable people on the earth. You are the most honored. You are the most precious. And look, we are. Right? To God, we are his precious people. We are his people. I don't think it's a problem saying that we are a great commodity, as it were, to God. We're very valuable to God. But I don't think that's what Jesus means here. So let me give you a second option. A second option is that salt creates thirst. Salt creates thirst. And so the presence of Christians in the earth is to, watch this, create thirst for God and righteousness. You got that? That's how some would argue. Let me say that again. Salt creates thirst, and therefore the presence of Christians in the earth is to create a thirst for God and righteousness. Some of you have heard of James Montgomery Boyce, the commentator, the preacher, now with the Lord. He held to this view. He actually wrote a book, and he titled it, "Do You Make Me Thirsty?" Arguing that the purpose of being salt of the earth is to make the earth thirsty. Thirst for righteousness. Someone else asked, very similar, in another title, "Is your witness making an unbeliever thirsty? Or have I ever made anyone thirsty for the Lord Jesus Christ?" So again, they're all getting to this idea that, well, if we're going to take the salt metaphor correctly, salt means you make somebody thirsty, and therefore that's our job in the world. We're making unbelievers thirsty for God, thirsty for Christ, thirsty for righteousness. And I guess, you know, you look at that and you say, well, it is true. Anybody swallowed a cup full of salt? You immediately want to shoot it down with some water or something. It does make you thirsty, right? But again, I don't think Jesus had in mind salt creating thirst as a primary purpose. So let's consider it a third option. And perhaps here we're getting a little bit closer to the truth. Salt seasons and flavors. And so Christians are to season and flavor society. You got that? Let me say that again. Salt seasons and flavors, and so Christians are to season and flavor society. I found it interesting that the Oxford English Dictionary has one of its meanings to the word season, the idea of, like this, giving zest to. Giving zest to. I like that. Giving zest to. When you season something, you're giving zest to. And I thought, well, that's what a Christian should be, right? A Christian should be giving zest out there. He should have zest. That is, he should have zeal, and therefore he gives a zest. Sinclair Ferguson explains it this way. Seasoning society is not a matter of being Scrooge, like personalities, whose presence brings a pall of depression and whose entrance marks the exit of joy. On the contrary, the presence of God's people should, quote, increase the flavor of life in many different ways. After all, we can come to our friends, neighbors, co-workers, or fellow students as those who have been and still are in the presence of Jesus Christ, who has given us abundant life. Everything about us should express attractiveness as well as the holiness of our Lord. End quote. I don't think anybody is going to disagree with that. I mean, he's absolutely right. Everything we do and everything we say should have a sense of salt about us. We should be giving zest, as it were, to everyone around us. I mean, there is a seasoning aspect, a flavoring aspect of our lives in society. I mean, Paul, if you remember in Colossians 4:6, says that our speech should always be what? With grace, seasoned with salt. Is he bouncing off Jesus then and as the salt of the earth? Ephesians 4:29, very similar. Do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths, but only what is helpful for building others up according to their needs, that it may be benefit those who listen. And that's just another way of saying that your speech should be seasoned, right? So again, this view holds that all of our lives, not just our speech, though we all know that our speech is the best indicator, right? Right? You want to know somebody, what's going on in their heart, just tell them to open up their tongue. Because the tongue is a tattletale, right? Isn't that what James says? It reveals the heart. So, again, this view holds that all of our lives, not just our speech, should season and flavor society. That's what it means to be salt of the earth. We're just a seasoning agent, as it were. We flavor everybody. And that should be exemplified. You're saying, well, what does that look like? Well, it should be exemplified by our joy, our peace, our contentment. I mean, everybody sees that joy. Everybody sees that peace. Everybody sees that contentment. And they're going to turn around and go, why? How? How come you have so much joy? How come you're so content? How come you're so peaceful? And by the way, if that is the purpose of the metaphor here, then we're doing a horrible job of it, right? Christians haven't done a good job of doing this at all. One writer said, Christians, instead of water, look and act like they've been baptized in lemon juice, right? Remember that book by Martin Lloyd-Jones, Spiritual Depression? Remember the whole reason why he did a series on that? Well, really twofold. One is to help people deal with their spiritual depression, but also in helping them deal with it to make sure they understood that Christians, by continually being spiritually depressed, are not a good recommendation for the faith. Right? You say I'm a Christian and God has changed me and transformed me and you're dull and the dumps constantly, and people are going to go, yeah, what change? Even Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, I might have entered the ministry of certain clergymen I knew had they not acted and looked so much like undertakers. End quote. So salt, seasons and flavors. Christians are to season, flavor, you could say give zest to the earth. And so the question comes, is this what Jesus meant here? Is this what Jesus meant? And all I can say is, maybe. But let's move on to a fourth option. And one that provides perhaps a consensus amongst most modern commentators. I mean, if you were to survey, 20 commentators on the Sermon on the Mount, this is probably, out of the 20, 18 would say this is what Jesus means by being salt of the earth. Everybody mentions this, and that is salt. Listen, salt was used as a preservative. You probably heard that one before, right? Salt was used as a preservative, and so Christians are to preserve a rotting and decaying society. Let me just say that so we're all up to speed. Salt was used as a preservative, and so Christians are to preserve a rotting and decaying society. Now, granted, this might be foreign to most of us, but before refrigerators and before freezers, how would you preserve meat and fish? You would just rub them in salt. You would just pack them down in loads of salt. That's because salt has a preserving quality. Salt kills the bacteria responsible for spoilage. Without salt, it wouldn't take long for meat and fish to decay, become putrid, and rot. And so, we know the presupposition is that the world is rotten and decaying, and so one way to keep it from not rotting and corrupting and decaying at a rapid pace, you put salt through it, and that's us. We are the salt. We slow down the process. You could say we're an antiseptic, put it another way. But the thought is we're a preservative. Here's the thought behind it. As the ancient people would have had to take salt and rub it deeply into the meat, literally saturate it, drown it, so to speak, with salt. That is the meat. On that analogy, so we as Christians are to rub deeply into society, to come into personal contact with society, so to be a preservative for them so they don't completely corrupt. Does that make sense? One writer explains it this way, quote, Christians whose lives exhibit the qualities of the blessed will have a preserving impact upon a society that, if left to itself, will rot and deteriorate. Without the influence of the gospel, society will suffer moral decay and become putrid, unfit for the consumption of good men and women. End quote. In other words, according to this view, listen, our holy, Christ-like character will check the rottenness and decay of the world. Our presence in the world should hold back crime. Our presence should moderate our co-workers' language. Our presence should keep back blasphemy. And as a result, there'll be more respect for others. That'll be more common. Those with whom you work should develop something of a conscience about the standards of their work, and so on and so forth. You kind of understand that if you're in the workplace. I remember when I was working at the bank, they'd be saying whatever they want to say, and Todd turns the corner and they, Todd's here. They don't want to talk the way they would talk if I was in there. Another writer puts it this way, your life will save others from yielding to the immoral pressures by which our contemporary world is characterized. When you are the salt of the earth, you preserve society, end quote. In other words, you have a moralizing influence. That's really the issue. You have a moralizing influence. Even John Stott asks this penetrating question. He says, when society goes bad, we Christians tend to throw up our hands in pious horror and reproach the non-Christian world. But should we not reproach ourselves? One can hardly blame unsalted meat for going bad. It cannot do anything else. The real question to ask is, where is the salt? End quote. Now that's a very good question. Again, back to the presupposition. That's where we got to start and make sure we got that right. Whatever the salt is, we know what the earth is. The society is decaying. It is decaying and going from bad to worse. And in one sense, we shouldn't be surprised, right? And so the question comes, what's going to stop that process? What's going to retard that process? What is it going to take to slow down the spoilage, so to speak? Well, the answer is here. Many would say it's salt. It's salt. The church is salt. The church is the preservative. It needs Christians sprinkled and scattered all across society, rubbing shoulder to shoulder with them, conversing with the intellectuals, working with the sinners, dining with the tax collectors. I mean, isn't that what Jesus did? Some would even say, you know, you got to be like Jesus. Many a times he went outside of the clubhouse of his disciples and mingled and influenced and preserved the society around him. Christians then, this view says, we as salt are to be a preservative of the decaying and corrupt evil world. I think you got that. That was number four. And while all of that might be true, and just as it's true that salt creates thirst and that salt creates flavor, I do believe there's a better option. I believe there's a better option for our understanding of salt here. And so here's number five on our list. And as I said, I believe this is the primary purpose Jesus had in mind when he spoke these words, "You are salt of the earth." And here it is. Ready? Salt was a purifying and cleansing agent. And so Christians are to be agents of purifying and cleansing. In other words, with the use of salt, the church are agents of transformation. Let me say that again. Salt was a purifying and cleansing agent. Yes, it's seasoned. Yes, it created thirst. Yes, it was used as a preservative, but it also had another function. I told you it had 11 functions in the ancient world. But salt was a purifying and cleansing agent, and so Christians are to be agents in themselves, or better word, ambassadors, of purifying and cleansing. Or, to say it another way, as salt, we are the agents of transformation, because it's exactly what salt did back then. It changed. It changed from impure to pure. Salt had cleansing qualities. Salt had purifying qualities. Salt had transforming qualities. And those are the same qualities we are to have in the world as well. That actually fits the light parallel better than any other option I've given you so far. Because you do have to come back to the light. If they are in parallel, how does season fit with light? How does thirst parallel with light? How does preservative parallel with light? As I said, I believe this is the best view. This is the primary purpose. We're on the point purpose here. This is the primary purpose Jesus had in mind when he said this. So you come back to the text then. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. Again, what's the goal of the salt and the light here? Well, again, they go together. Both have a common function. They both have a common goal. And what is that? What's the goal? Well, verse 16. Look at the end of verse 16. Here's the common goal. That men would what? You got to read verses 13 right through 16. You can't just stop at 14 and separate the two. They both go together. And so if they both go together, you got to read toward the end and ask yourself, well, what is the goal of it all? The goal is that men would what? Glorify your Father who is in heaven, right? So let me ask you this. Does salt-stimulating thirst do that? Does salt-creating flavor do that? Does salt as a preservative do that? And the answer is what? No, no, no. What needs to happen for someone to come to the point of glorifying God, how? What do they need? They need to be what? It's not a trick question. They need to be saved, right? The only way anybody glorifies God is that they say. They need to be cleansed. They need to be made pure. They need to be transformed. And that's, again, what I'm arguing here. That's what salt does. It is an agent of cleansing from defilement. Salt and light together are the agents of transformation. Let me put it another way. Just think about this. Maybe you've done this study and you're dead set. No, Todd, option number 4 is for me. Option number 3 is for me. Well, let me ask you this. Does this evil and perverse society need preserving or transforming? That's one way to put it. Is our function in the world really to make society less immoral? Oh, we might have a moralizing influence, and it'd be a moralizing influence till they all go to hell. And if we are only about a moralizing influence, then how are we different than the Roman Catholics? They have a moralizing influence. What about the Muslims or the Jews or the Mormons? All these moral religions. How would we be different to them if all we are another moralizing influence? Does that make sense? I mean, all of them, in a sense, are preserving society and their moralism. Now, that's why I said the preface that, you know, with all five, there's an element of truth in all of them. I just think number 5 is the best option because I do believe Jesus had one option in mind. But I understand there's a preserving aspect function to us. I get that. But at the end of the day, what sinners need most is not preservation, but what? Transformation. Transformation. Sinners don't need to be made thirsty. They need to be made to drink. Sinners don't simply need seasoning and zest in their lives. What they need is a new life. Right? And this is what salt does. It makes them clean. It makes them pure. It removes all defilement. It transforms them into vessels of honor. And we as Christians are the agents of God to do just that. That's our function. Turn it all the way back to where we began. Our job, our function is to be salt. Well, what does that mean? Again, this is our conduct in the world. One writer put it this way. You are the salt of the earth means that Jesus' disciples are to seek to transform. Form corrupt human societies, not merely to preserve it, end quote. There it is. In fact, we could add this. If there is to be any preserving, if we want to keep that for any purpose, preserving only comes after what? Purifying. The question then is how? How does that happen? How does that happen? How do we as salt have the purifying and transforming effect on society? How does that happen? Well, that's point number 4, the plan. We've looked at the presupposition, we've looked at the purposes, and now the plans. What's the means of transformation? Come back next Sunday night and we'll find out. Let's close in a word of prayer.